So far, so good. So welcome, everybody, to the first Citizens Climate Lobby International Call for 2013. What's going to be happening is just a moment. We're going to invite our guest, Rob Willer, who's been back for the second time, and actually the first time that Dr. Willer was on the call was a game changer for Citizens Climate Lobby, so we're really excited about having him on the call again today. After that happens, we're going to be going over some forms that we have. So one of the things that we're asking people to do as part of the call today is actually plan out and set goals for what you want to accomplish for 2013. So we exist inside of two commitments. One is to create the political will for a stable climate, and the other is to empower people to have breakthroughs in their personal and political power. So we're asking people to plan out what you want to accomplish really in both areas. So there's one thing of the amount of activity that you want to generate individually and as a group to generate political will. But then there's the other issue, and that is having people have breakthroughs in their personal and political power. So in addition to doing planning and goal setting work this month with respect to the actions to generate political will, we're essentially asking you to also answer the question, who do you need to be as an individual, as a group, as an organization to meet the enormous challenge that we have? So part of the process today is not only to educate ourselves, but also go through the process of planning the year out. You know, we do a lot of planning in other areas, education, financial, even vacations. But rarely do we stop and say, how am I planning to contribute to make a difference? And we think that's a really important part of the January call this year. After that, we're going to get a report of what happened this year. We'll just get a very quick assessment of what happened last year and compare it to what happened this year. Then we'll get some specific reports from the field of some things that happened that I think everybody will be excited about, or as we call it, what happens when Ellie from Richmond decides to seduce the Wall Street Journal. So we'll just call that as our category for reports from the field. After that, we'll go over what the actions are for the U.S., and I'll go over the U.S. actions. Kathy will go over what we're doing in Canada. And then Marshall, our founder and president, is going to go over this month's laser talk. So before we do all that, though, let me just say that I really, really want to welcome our new chapters, Fayetteville, Kenosha, Racine, and then last night, Westchester, New York started. So that's really, really exciting to have a brand new group that just started last night. Before I introduce Dr. Willer, let me just say a little bit about the people you're talking to. I think there are a lot of people that with respect to the issue of global warming and climate change are very, very what I would call in a high category of passion. But I don't think there's that many people that are what I would call a high level of performance because they're not making much stuff happen. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that most people don't understand the things that they can do to actually influence the process. The people that you're talking to today are at a very high level of passion, but also a very high level of performance. So let me just give you one indicator of what I mean by a high level of performance. So 2 years ago, the people on this call generated 181 letters to the editor on putting an effective pricing mechanism on carbon. I think that's a high level of performance. But this year, the people on the call generated over 535 letters to the editor on putting an effective pricing mechanism on carbon. So I would call that both high passion and high performance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Dr. Willer, last time he was on, he was talking about his paper, Dire Messages, Reduce Belief in Global Warming by Contradicting Just World Beliefs. Now, that was just a miracle for me because I was starting to come to the conclusion that most of my friends were just stupid. And I couldn't understand why I explained to them what was going on, and then they would change the subject and say, well, I'm so glad you're doing that, but, you know, do you think we're going to win the game tomorrow? In fact, I was secretly keeping a list of all the places that they went to college so I wouldn't tell anybody to send their kids there. But then after your talk with us 3 years ago, I realized that if we weren't communicating solutions, we weren't really helping. So that was just a change in the way we were going about our work. So what I was hoping today is, first of all, because when you were on 3 years ago, there was 12 groups and about 60 or 70 people on the call. Today there's 73 organized chapters. There's a 25 more that are probably on in the process of starting a chapter, and probably somewhere between 400 and 500 people on the call. So most of them didn't actually hear your initial remarks. So if you wouldn't mind just doing a brief you know, recap of what that paper was about. And then after that, what I'd like to do is get to your current work, which is the differences in moral views between the way Republicans and Democrats deal with big issues. And when, once we've done that, if there's time for questions, we'll start in San Francisco and then go Toronto and then Omaha, Nebraska. So, Dr. Willer, so great to have you again. Thank you for making yourself available on a Saturday morning again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks thanks for having me back. And it's a real pleasure to be talking with you all again. I had a great time speaking with you all 2 years ago. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of this organization and its efforts. And, you know, really, it's truly a privilege to be able to chat with you all. So to talk a little bit about this research that we put out 2 years ago that I talked about before when the organization was smaller, it's amazing how big it is now. In that research, we were interested in the puzzle of why it is that people don't believe in global warming. So as you all know, there's all this evidence, mounting evidence, that global warming is real, but at the same time, substantial numbers of Americans deny that global warming exists or are highly skeptical about it, and the huge impediment to change. And when we looked around for a possible explanation of why this might be, it occurred to us that global warming presents a very real threat to people's fundamental beliefs about the world. There's a research tradition in psychology that's decades long that finds that people are deeply committed to viewing the world as just and fair, stable and predictable, and so on. And if you think about it, this is sort of the first theory you would make about the world, right? You would say, okay, the world is as it is, and tomorrow it'll be roughly the way it is today. And then after that, you can develop more complex theories about how the world works that you layer upon that. And when information arises that threatens this basic belief about how the world works, people tend to disregard that information, or at least they're very motivated to. They would like to if they have any excuse to at all. And so we thought maybe this is part of what's happening with global warming skepticism. Maybe people find that global warming is a threat to this fundamental belief about the world, and then they disregard it as a result. And one thing that's interesting about the theory is that it might not just explain global warming skepticism, but also identify a way out. Because it would suggest that if you could package messages about how bad global warming is with information about how one could address it, how you could successfully counteract global warming, climate change, that people would have something else that they could do with their discomfort. They'd have something else they could do with their cognitive dissonance. They could believe in global warming and they could take action. So we tested our reasoning about this in a couple different ways. And I'm just talking about one of the studies here. We conducted an experiment where we measured people's belief in global warming on a survey, and then we brought them into a laboratory environment and had them read a short media report about a recent climate science conference. And the article concluded with either a sort of dire, scary message about global warming and its impending, the impending destruction that will be associated with climate change, or with a more positive, solution-oriented ending that emphasized that while global warming is a very, very serious problem, it could be successfully counteracted with, in this case, technological investment and innovation. And what we found was that the subjects in the study who read the more positive message tended to increase their belief in global warming, but those who read the dire, more apocalyptic message believed less in global warming. And furthermore, we found that these patterns were especially strong among people who scored as high in belief in the world as just and stable and orderly. Those people that especially hold this fundamental view about the world were especially threatened by just purely negative messages. And what these results show is a few things. So first, one of the factors that drives global warming skepticism is this fundamental tendency that people have to believe that the world is predictable and stable and fair. It is a deeply held belief of many people. It tends to be more common amongst more conservative people, and it's closely tied to global warming skepticism in this research and other research. Second, really negative, dire messages about global warming are especially likely to backfire because they threaten that belief. But lastly, we find that, you know, more positive messages can actually work really well. And so you can actually see some pretty negative stuff about the severity of global warming if you package that with a solution. People don't want to believe in something that might not be fixable. But if it is fixable, then you can direct their concern towards action.
Great, great. Well, thank you again for that very succinct recap, and I know that the majority of people on this call didn't hear you. They've heard us talk about you endlessly. As you and I talked about a couple of weeks ago, I think Citizens Climate Lobby is the, clearly the biggest expert in the world on your paper out there because we talk about it so much. So let's get on to your current work. So, you know, currently you're working on the differences in moral views between Republicans and Democrats and how that shapes, you know, messaging and how you resonate with various groups. So what would you like to tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. So in the years since we worked on this first project, we've gotten interested in how you could develop a more diverse toolkit of messaging strategies for advocating for progressive causes, with an emphasis on constructing effective pro-environmental messages. And so we've been interested in, you know, what are some other ways that we could construct effective pro-environmental messages that would be uniquely persuasive to conservatives in America, because obviously conservative Americans tend to be less supportive of environmental reform in general, not always, but specifically. So this study was again conducted with a co-author and former student of mine, Matthew Feinberg, and we got really interested in research on the link between morality and politics, and specifically on the different moral convictions that form the basis of liberal and conservative political positions. And in scouring this new emerging literature that links people's moral concerns with their political positions, we came to a few different conclusions about what this literature is about. So first, this literature has found that liberals and conservatives tend to endorse somewhat different moral convictions, and they tend to make political messages in terms of the values that they think are important. However, these sorts of messages will tend to be uniquely ineffective for reaching people on the other side of the political spectrum. It's sort of like if you went to Mexico and ordered food and you were speaking in French. It's just not going to be as effective as if you spoke in a language that was persuasive to your audience. And so if you were to craft your political messages in terms of the moral convictions of your audience, they would likely be more successful. And so this was our reasoning, was that right now people have a tendency to argue in terms of their own moral convictions and their own moral reasons for political positions, and it would be more effective to reframe those messages in terms of the moral convictions of your audience. So we decided to test our ideas in the environmental domain first. And our main idea here was to try to make a pro-environmental message in terms of conservative moral values. But you might be wondering, what are conservative moral values? Okay, so past research has found that overwhelmingly liberals tend to endorse two different moral domains as the sort of main moral convictions that matter to liberal political reasoning. So one of those is harm and care. So liberals are very responsive to, you know, whether something is harmful or whether it involves protecting someone or something. Also, liberals care a lot about fairness and equality. Conservatives care about these things somewhat, but not as much as liberals. The liberal political arguments tend to be in terms of these domains, and they are a little bit less persuasive to conservatives than they are to other liberals. Conservatives have a variety of moral values that liberals don't tend to endorse or even really recognize as bases of morality. So these include respect for authority, in-group loyalty, so loyalty to your group, and also purity and sanctity. So a lot of conservative moral reasoning is based in terms of protecting the purity and sanctity of things that are pure, protecting them from contamination or desecration. So what we were thinking is, okay, so if these are the uniquely conservative moral values, would it maybe be persuasive to make a pro-environmental message in terms of these values? So we designed an experiment in which we showed a couple hundred people that were recruited over the internet, these normal Americans who use the internet, and we showed them a pro-environmental message that was either based in terms of harm and care moral values or purity and sanctity moral values. And so the harm and care pro-environmental message was pretty typical. It's the kind of thing that you're probably accustomed to seeing. And so it said things like, now more than ever, it's important that we protect our natural habitat and start caring more about the environment. That, you know, that sort of thing, you know, a simple expression of care and the need to protect the environment. But the purity message that we made was really different. And it was even sort of unusual. And it was kind of hard to write because we had never really read a message like this. And so it said things like, now more than ever, it's important that we protect our natural habitats from desecration and pollution. Keeping our forests, drinking waters, and skies pure is of vital importance. We should regard the pollution of the places we live in to be disgusting. And so here we were specifically trying to talk a lot about purity, the sanctity of natural habitat, and we were also trying to provoke a disgust reaction. So we showed people, we showed pictures of somebody drinking a glass of dirty, polluted water, for example. And this is because past research finds that conservatives aren't just uniquely responsive to messages about purity, but also to disgust reactions. So disgust undergirds a lot of conservative political positions on issues like same-sex marriage and abortion and so on. And what we found was that when we showed participants in the study the harm and care message that was, you know, the kind of message they were probably used to seeing, you get the same story of political polarization on the environment that you ever see, or that you typically see, I should say. Liberals expressed high levels of support for the environment, conservatives did not. However, when we showed participants this purity and sanctity-based message, we found that political polarization on environmental issues was eliminated. So conservatives expressed much higher levels of environmental concern, much higher levels of support for environmental action, essentially levels that were indistinguishable from the liberal participants in the study. So it lifted conservative environmental concern, reported environmental concern, to the same levels as liberals. And we even found that conservatives expressed greater belief in global warming, and this is despite the fact that the message didn't even mention global warming. It was just a general environmental message. And so what we took these results to mean is that if you were to reframe a message in terms of the moral values of conservatives and argue in terms of the conviction of the target audience, those who are not concerned about the environment, it can be much more effective. So in our paper, we tried to do some other things as well. You know, we tried to make the case that one of the reasons that environmental issues have become so polarized is because of these kinds of dynamics. And we showed that liberals tend to perceive the environment in moral terms and conservatives don't, and that that's one of the critical reasons why liberals are willing to take costly action in support of the environment and environmental issues, where conservatives are not. Because for conservatives, even conservatives who maybe are sympathetic to environmental concerns, but it doesn't cross into being a moral issue, they're not really willing to necessarily suffer a great deal of cost or increase taxes or what have you in support of this position. It has to be a moral position for you to say, okay, the cost, it's worth it. It's worth the cost. So the paper does a few things, but I kind of wanted to focus here in this talk on just this messaging part and how it is that you could get conservative through strategic moral messaging to support environmental reform more and suffer personal cost. So just to conclude this summary of this research, the main implications of this work are probably the following. So first, there's nothing inevitable about conservatives being anti-environment or apathetic on environmental issues at all. I think if you look historically, there's actually a deeper track record of conservatives making important contributions to, for example, the early 20th century conservation movement. So conservatives are certainly, I think, reachable on environmental issues. It's just very difficult in the present political domain. Second, constructing messages that are based on conservative moral values will be much more effective than ones that are based in liberals' moral values. Additionally, while we only studied purity messages here, it's likely that other kinds of messages that are articulated in terms of conservative morality could also be very effective. So that would be messages in terms of patriotism, loyalty to your family, religious sanctity, respect for authority figures. those kinds of messages are going to be ones that agree with the sort of moral grammar that conservatives are fluent in, that liberals are maybe not. And then more generally, I guess we would say that getting into the the head of your audience and making arguments that appeal to them in terms that uniquely resonate with them is, of course, a good way to go. And it's not just effective, it's also respectful. And I think the audience hears that respect when they hear an argument that's tailored to them.
Great. Boy, you know, Rob, one of the things that we have worked really hard on is to try and work with people outside of the kind of default way of dealing with people of, you know, if I'm right, the people I disagree with are wrong. And I just think that this just gives us a ton of more ammunition to work on to continue to find common ground with people that we might not by our default setting. So I think this is going to be another game changer for us. Do you mind if we go out to the field and take some questions?
Not at all. That'd be great.
Okay, good. We're going to start in San Francisco and then Toronto and then Wisconsin, and, I mean, in Madison, and we'll see where we are at that time. So, San Francisco, Toronto, Omaha. I apologize. So, Matt in Toronto, you had sent an email with a question you wanted to ask. Are you there, Matt? If you could, it may just take a moment, but if you *6 your phone, it should unmute it. So, Matt, if you could take a second and just say your name so we can know we can hear you, hear us respond, and then we'll get. Sometimes just a sec, Rob.
Sure.
Matt, are you there? Okay, sometimes we end up taking people out of order because it takes a couple times with *6 in the phone. Let's try Toronto. Cheryl, is there anybody up there in Toronto that wanted to also ask a question? Susan, can they unmute their lines? Okay, let's try Omaha. We might do this in reverse order.
Mark, it's Susan. If you know their phone numbers, I can unmute them.
Okay, I don't. Sorry. That's okay. All right, Rob, I know the nature of Rob's question in San Francisco. He was really interested in kind of the contrast between how messaging might work with younger people as contrasted with what he called older Midwesterns. Now, I know that's a kind of old, really broad category for you to try and get into, and I think I understand his question. But can you say something about that?
Yeah. We haven't done research on age divides specifically. I mean, I can say that younger conservatives are probably more likely to have deep moral commitments to issues like in-group loyalty and patriotism than they are to purity and sanctity, which is more associated with religion and traditional conservative social values, which are less present in younger conservatives. So I guess I was trying to give a quick answer on how can you communicate effectively with young conservatives. It would be I would go first to patriotism and in-group loyalty and talking about how, you know, environmental reform is a critical issue and addressing climate change is a critical issue if we're going to make this country great and if we're going to keep up with rival nations and things like that.
Yeah. Is there any chance if we, you know, start to craft our message more around a conservative moral view of the world, is there any chance of that reducing the impact with people who have a liberal view of the world, or are you pretty confident that they're, solid enough on the issue that they'd stay with us?
Well, I mean, so that's an awesome question. There's a couple potential drawbacks of this sort of messaging strategy. So one, if you're not effectively micro-targeting conservatives, if you're using public fora where liberals are exposed as well, there's some concern that liberals might get turned off. Now, we don't find that in our research. We find that liberals, when they're exposed to these messages, do not get turned off from supporting the environment. But I do think if you're trying to move liberals or people that are already convinced on environment, that they're strongly supportive of the environment, if you're trying to move them from support to action, it would be good to separately message them, you know, in the way that's most persuasive and effective to them. And all this purity and patriotism business, you know, might not resonate with them and might not be the way to move them to action. So I guess, you know, the best would be if you could not just tailor a message to your audience, but somehow deploy it so that only that audience that's being specifically targeted hears it.
Good. Well, let me just see if any of the people who we called on had a chance to unmute themselves. Anybody from San Francisco, Omaha, or Toronto?
Mark, it's Cheryl in Toronto. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Cheryl.
Okay, wonderful. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much. It's really fascinating work. Thank you for all the work you're doing. First of all, the obvious question is how can we get access to this report, because this is going to be very handy when we speak to conservatives. And also, did you do any work in terms of this sense of the economy versus the environment argument? Conservatives tend to think that if we do anything to the environment, we're going to somehow harm the economy. And I don't know if you looked into messaging that helped counter that.
Yeah, these are excellent questions. So I would be, you know, very happy to make all of these materials available to you all through your website or, you know, whatever is the easiest way to get them out to you. As to this question of how you counter economy-based counter-arguments, you know, we didn't in this research study, you know, how much these sorts of messages can stand up to counter-arguments about damaging the economy. This is, I agree with you, this is absolutely the most difficult counter-argument to deal with. Our thinking was that people would be more willing to endure some economic costs and possibly also some uncertainty about the economic impact of large-scale, you know, climate change efforts if they thought that it was a moral issue to address the environment. And this is something that's supported in a variety of research that, you know, if it's an issue that you're just concerned about, like, I'm concerned about climate change, I'm not exactly sure how likely it is to happen, but it sounds pretty bad, and I generally believe in it. And then you say, but then I also know there'll be this short-term, or you believe you know that there's a short-term economic cost. You sort of lay these things out on a spreadsheet, and you might say, you know what, it's not worth it. But if instead you said, you know what, because of my family or the importance of this being a great nation or the importance of preserving the purity and sanctity of natural spaces, because of these kinds of concerns, addressing climate change is for me a moral issue, then you're not necessarily going to weigh it on a balance sheet next to economic costs. You might say, you know what, we just have to take action. You know, we have a moral imperative to do so. And so that was part of our reasoning in pursuing this sort of morality-based messaging strategy that might be uniquely effective at standing up to concerns about economic costs.
Great. Let me just see if either Omaha or San Francisco had a chance to unmute their line.
And Mark, it's Matt in San Francisco.
Yeah, Matt, please go ahead.
Thanks. Well, you kind of answered already, Rob, the first question on the moral battle, and just I guess my question relates, or two parts, so you can pick and choose, but relates more to, you know, kind of taking the next step strategically, politically, you know, with the red states. So, for example, religion. So if you can touch on that, if there's any more to add. But then in addition to being a moral battle, if it's more pressing, it's also a generational battle. So what is your messaging sense, advice on, you know, inspiring, infuriating, however you want to look at it, the younger generation who's, you know, really got more at stake in this?
Yeah, these are excellent questions. So, you know, we have not yet made a religion-based pro-environmental or pro-climate change legislation message and tested it specifically. Obviously, this purity and sanctity message that we were studying overlaps with religious concerns. We didn't find it was uniquely effective amongst religious people. It tended to just be effective for conservatives in general. But I think that there's a lot of potential there for religious people to be reached on climate change in terms of their religious convictions. I think that that's sort of an untapped messaging strategy that I think there's a lot there. It would not be very hard to come up with a lot of ways in which addressing global warming is a way to be a devout and good religious person and a way to be true to important sacred religious principles. I think that sort of message makes good sense and can be very effective. And my understanding is there are actually, and you all would know more about this than me, but there are significant religious environmental organizations in Europe, and Christianity and environmentalism are seen as sort of morally consistent and ethically consistent over there, where here they're seen as just sort of unrelated to one another, I think. As for different age cohorts and views of global warming and climate change and willingness to sacrifice, I think that there's a lot of potential there, right? Because younger people do believe in global warming at higher rates and seem more concerned. And I mean, what I would love to see is something like what we're seeing now with same-sex marriage, where in an extremely short period of time, people are flipping at very high rates. And now you're even seeing, you know, 8 years after Bush made a gay marriage ban central to his 2004 campaign, you now see prominent conservatives talking about how they have to flip on same-sex marriage, or they may need to consider flipping as a party on that issue. Now, why did that happen? I think it had a lot to do with virtually extremely high levels of young people being totally fine with gay rights and same-sex marriage, and people being widely exposed to those people speaking that position. And so I think that can be one way to get this viewpoint into every household and, you know, in every home and every church in America. It's through the youth of America. So I think that kind of strategy can be great.
Great. Well, and you know, it's interesting, Rob, one of our previous speakers, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, you know, is a Canadian-trained climate scientist who teaches at one of the universities in Texas, and she's by faith evangelical, and her husband's an evangelical preacher. And one of the things she was saying is that all of those people's faith says that they should be good stewards of the environment and that it's easy to make a case for stewardship with them.
See, I like that. That sort of message sounds great to me because it's religious, it's respectful to religion, but then it's also consistent with this authority respect thing, you know, rise to a position of authority and importance and responsibility, you know, and be a good steward of the environment. That sort of thing would, I would think, be very, very persuasive to a lot of conservative
Americans. Let me just check. Omaha, did you have any luck unmuting your phone? Okay, well, then let me just ask you one other thing then. So, you know, some of our people have thought that perhaps the right way of framing this is kind of in the same way Americans viewed the space race, in that we were in a race towards something and we wanted to win, and that perhaps saying that we are in a race to the clean energy economy and that, you know, it's maybe us, China, Germany, who are the people who have the greatest chance of winning that race. There's some people in our organization who think that we ought to try and create almost the kind of space race mentality in that we want to be the first one to the clean economy. Do you think there's anything worth pursuing there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that kind of messaging strategy would be really effective. I think that could be one of several, you know, several prongs in a multi-pronged messaging approach that would be more persuasive to more Americans. Conservatives are very responsive to patriotism-based messages and international competition-based messages. And so I guess I would say that a friendly amendment to the messaging strategy you were just summarizing of thinking of it as an international competition and akin to the space race, I would add to that, the more language you can have about these sorts of efforts making America great and being fundamental to what makes America great and makes us all proud to be Americans and our ability to be successful in huge collective endeavors like these, you know, like our efforts in World War II, like our efforts in the space race, these huge collective national endeavors, when we're successful at them, it makes our country great, and this is the next one we're going to do, and we're going to win this one too. You know, that kind of message, I think, could be really successful.
Great. Okay, good. Well, in just a moment, we do need to transition to doing a couple of other things we do on the call. Is there anything else that you wanted to get to or that you wanted to address before we move to the next part of the call?
No, I didn't really have anything to end, but this has been really fun and interesting. I enjoyed these questions, and I just appreciate all of your excellent work. It's deeply valued.
Great. Well, as usual, when you're on the call, it went too fast again. as soon as your next paper's done, we're the first organization that wants to know what it is, and we'll have you back again.
I can't wait.
Yeah. If you want to stick around for a couple minutes, I think you'll be interested in the kinds of things some people have produced over the last year. But if you have to go, we certainly know it's a Saturday, and we don't want to take up any extra of your time. But if you can stay on, I think you might find some of what people are working on pretty interesting. So, again, Dr. Willey, thank you so much. It changed what we were, the way we were doing when you were on last time. And again, this is going to really just add an enormous amount to how we're able to do what we're doing. So thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure. Yeah, this has been great.
Great.
Mark, we may have Omaha on the line.
Okay, Omaha, if you're there, okay, even though we wrapped this up, we'll still, because we said you could ask a question, we'll let you do one. Are you there?
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay, Susan. You can threaten me with those things and not always have it happen.
Okay.
All right, well, the next people that we're going to try and unmute in just a moment is going to be Ellie in Farmville, Virginia, and then Massachusetts, and then Wisconsin. So hopefully they'll be able to unmute themselves, but if they can't, if you can help with it, Susan, that would be great. Ellie's number is an 804 number. So one of the things I mentioned at the start of the call is we're going to be doing some planning week, and there's forms that you have, both an individual planning form and a group planning form. And then we have a list of, you know, how you work people on a championship scale, moving your member of parliament or your member of Congress up the scale, so they might be with us, they might be against us, they might be a champion already, but we want to move everybody up. Regarding the two forms, this is something that is entirely for you and your group. This isn't anything we're going to ask you for. We're not going to follow up on it. We're not going to ask you to send it in. We just think that there's an enormous amount of benefit of stopping, reflecting upon what got done last year. So we do want you, as part of the process, to take an account of what you accomplished last year, what you're excited about, maybe if there's anything you're disappointed about that you want to take a look at. And I think one of the good questions to ask, given the nature of our work every year, is how did you surprise yourself this year? I'd like you to write that question down, because it's not on any of the forms. But if you would write down the question, how did you surprise yourself this year? I think it's a good question to answer. And what we're looking for is for you to set goals, do planning for something that would be a stretch for you this year. You know, your group might have gotten 5 letters to the editor last year. You might have gotten 50 letters to the editor. So if you got 5 last year, if you decide to do 5 this year, that's probably not enough to get you inspired. So you want to set something that you would say, you know, that was really an achievement, something remarkable. We really had to bring something to the party. So you want to look both for yourself individually and as a group, and set some goals for what you're out to accomplish this year. Now, again, we gave you these forms as something to start a process. If you have something better, you should use that. If you have a better process than what we're offering, you should do it. But we do think it is really important at the beginning of the year to stop and say, okay, here's what we got done last year. Now let's set out to see what we can accomplish next year. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to have, in a few minutes, I'm going to have Amy recap what got done in 2012 as contrasted with 2011. But I wanted to start on just a couple of examples of things people are working on or accomplished recently as a background, as a context for what we're going to be doing this year. So first of all, Ellie Sparks in Farmville, Virginia, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can. So Ellie, first of all, if you could just give people a little bit of background on what got your attention on the Wall Street Journal. I mean, I think most people are familiar with the extraordinary work you did with the Richmond Times, and that kind of became the basis of our week work with all editorial boards, and it actually ends up now there's a direct correlation between the number of editorial board meetings we have and the number of editorials that get published in those papers on this issue, and much of that was sourced by the work you did in Richmond. And now you set your sights on the Wall Street Journal. So first of all, just give us a little bit of an inkling of what had you decide to focus on the Wall Street Journal, and then if you would read the email that you sent to the second most famous climate scientist in the country.
Okay. Well, actually, I think it was about a year and a half ago after one of our Saturday calls, I think it was Lazarowitz talking about the sort of 6 different places people can be in relationship to their thoughts about climate change, I was thinking, well, what makes someone who's a denier move to the next level and be more open to thinking about climate change? And so I said that to one of my volunteer friends, Mills, He's now in Germany, and he said, Ellie, you need to look up D.R. Tucker. He's a conservative writer who has made that transition. So I looked him up on the internet and decided to call him and contact him, and I did. And he spoke to me on the phone about his transformation. And then the next thing I know, I'm on DR's email list, which is a fabulous list to be on because he likes to look at what's happening at those on the big newspapers like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times that are sort of our nation's newspapers. And he would send out little links, here's this article, here's that article, here's what I think about it, and have this little conversation going. And I loved being part of his email. Well, one day he sends out something about his frustration about the Wall Street Journal. Here they go again. And he's so frustrated, and I'm feeling his pain. And then I think, well, hey, why can't we do to the Wall Street Journal what we did here in Richmond, which was take a very conservative paper, newspaper, and meet with them and befriend them and help them step up to the plate and maybe discover, as we did with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, that they really did understand climate change. They just hadn't been asked to become courageous on the issue. And so I set that to DR, and in a playful way, he said he'd have to wear a Teflon suit, and I said, no, we'd have to wear a tuxedo because we'd go out dancing afterwards. And then I thought to myself, well, who would I want to take with me if I went to the Wall Street Journal? And I thought, oh, I'd want to take a climate scientist. And then I remembered that I was on this email list with DR's, of DR's email list, with Michael Mann, that scientist who was getting into all kinds of trouble by the deniers because he's such a good climate scientist. And I thought, well, maybe I could reach out to Michael Mann and get him to join me on a visit to the Wall Street Journal. And so I emailed DR that I wanted to do that and could he facilitate an introduction. And then I thought, well, the heck with that. I've been posting on DR's email list, and so I could email Michael right away. I'm not even going to wait for DR, and so I did, and here's the email message that I sent to Michael Mann. I said, Michael, we've not formally met yet. I've seen your responses to DR's emails. I'm assuming you are the climate scientist, Michael Mann. Have I got that right? I am a Citizens Climate Lobby volunteer with nothing to lose. I'm also one fiercely dedicated to taking the CCL model to the next level. Because that, my friend, is where the breakthroughs hide. Going there takes me way out of my comfort zone, but the breakthroughs are so incredibly delicious and irresistible. For almost 2 years now, I've courted my local newspaper, the very conservative Richmond Times-Dispatch. The CCL work I've done with them has been exciting. The results have been surprising and delightful. I'd like to take it to the next level by bringing the Citizens Climate Lobby model of newspaper relationships to the Wall Street Journal. I think it is essential that we win over the finance industry in the call for a carbon tax. The Wall Street Journal is cornerstone to that win. When I went to my first meeting with the Times-Dispatch, I took along retired naval oceanographer, meteorologist Richard Taranto, CCL Executive Director Mark Reynolds, and CCL Communications Director Steve Ball. Richard answered the science questions and brought an air of authority to our meeting. Steve knew the carbon tax much better than I at that point. Mark was our excuse for the meeting. Our executive director is visiting from California. Would you please meet with us? I said in my initial call to the editorial board. How could they resist? I'd like to craft a similar team and head over to the Wall Street Journal. DR is going to join me. He's most familiar with the writers and the tone of the Wall Street Journal. Besides, he deserves a delicious CCL breakthrough. Judy Weiss has offered to join us, depending on the date of our meeting. For the Wall Street Journal, I'm sure we could get CCL Director Mark Reynolds out from San Diego. Would you please be my scientist? I think you would be the perfect addition, dare I say, anchor for our team. Thank you, Ellie Sparks. 804-475-6775. P.S. I'm giving you my phone number in the hope you will call me so we can talk more about this idea as you consider my request. And
what he said?
He said right away in an email, sure, he'd love to go. And then DR said, you know, the Wall Street Journal has been really mean to Michael Mann because, you know, they're part of the denier movement. And I said back, perfect. That's why we want to take him there, so they get to meet him in person, and they can stop that nasty behavior.
Great. There's about a hundred things I love about that, Ellie, but part of what I love is it's just so outrageous. I mean, who gives you permission to contact the second most famous climate scientist in the country and say, come to this meeting with you? You do. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for being outrageous again. You are definitely the leader in giving us all space to be more outrageous every single day. Fabulous. Okay, and Jessica in Boston. Are you there? Jessica in Boston. Okay, we'll try and circle back there in a second. How about Madeline in Madison? Are you there? Madeline, say your name so I know you're off the unmuted. Okay, we'll come back to them for a second. How about you, Amy Bennett? Are you there?
Mark, can you hear me? This is Amy.
I can hear you, and then we'll try and circle back to Jessica and Madeline in just a second if we can figure out how to unmute them. So can you give us an idea of what happened in 2011 versus 2012 in terms of some of the key categories that we're interested in?
Yes, Mark. Some of the categories that we really did a great job in were meetings with members of Congress. Last year, 2011, we had 255 meetings with members for the year. This year, 534. And letters to the editor, last year, 2011, we had 181, and this year, 537. Last year, editorials in newspapers, we had 12. In 2012, we had 22, Mark.
Great.
And to get more specific, with editorial board meetings, just for the month of December, this is very significant, we had 7 editorial board meetings, and lo and behold, we had 7 editorials printed. That's just in the month of December. And what I wanted to do was read you a few paragraphs of a recent editorial and tell you the story that's behind it. Last month, Steve Valk, our communications director, made a trip through a number of cities, including St. Louis, where Carol Brayford is the leader of the St. Louis chapter, and she arranged a meeting with the Post-Dispatch while Steve was there. He and another 4 members of the St. Louis chapter met with Kevin Horrigan, and he's the deputy editorial page director there. They had a great meeting and asked if the paper would please weigh in with an editorial supporting a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And Kevin said he'd write something before the end of the year. And on December 27th, they published a wonderful editorial that made many of the points that were brought up in the meeting. They even published the pie chart that many of us have seen on peer-reviewed climate change articles, showing that out of 13,950 peer-reviewed articles, only 24 disputed global warming. So I'd like to read just a couple highlights from that editorial, which was entitled, Save the Planet, Save Social Security, Save Medicaid, Tax Carbon. If Congress and the President were more rational than political, admittedly a very big if, they would kill a covey of birds with one stone. They could replace the payroll tax with a carbon tax. The editorial goes on to say, the carbon tax is an almost perfect solution to what economists call a Pigouvian problem created by carbon emissions. In 1920, the British economist Arthur Pigou noted that certain private investments, they impose costs on other people. You fill up your gas tank, you get the benefit of transportation. The gas station, its distributors, and the oil company all make money. But the cost of carbon emissions are borne by society in the form of climate change. A carbon tax would require those who use fossil fuels, which is everyone except a few people living very far off the grid, to pay for the social cost of global warming up front. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has estimated that a carbon tax of $80 per metric ton of emissions would keep disaster from happening by the end of the century. They finished the editorial with, an $80 a ton tax would cause gasoline prices to go up 70 to 80 cents a gallon. In a rational world, that would be the goal, with carbon taxes offset by payroll tax cuts and perhaps tax rebates to low-income Americans. It would also have to be accompanied by carbon tariffs imposed on those goods imported from countries that are not addressing the problem. The debate won't start at $80 a ton. Indeed, given the power of the fossil fuel lobby, it won't begin until several more years of killer storms, floods, and droughts. In a rational world, the debate would be well underway. And I just want to thank Carol for her work, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is one of the nation's leading newspapers. So this is really, really huge and really inspiring, and we hope that we'll all follow Carol's lead there.
Yeah, fantastic. And again, there just seems to be a direct correlation of every time we have an editorial board meeting, not only does the amount of activity spike up, but the amount of editorials does. I mean, included in last month's meetings, not only was the St. Louis, but also the L.A. Times, which we got a really strong response there also. Let me just check again real quick and see if there's any chance we were able to get Boston or Madison, either Jessica in Boston or Madeline.
I'm on. We should have Madeline.
Okay, Madeline, go ahead.
Okay, great. Well, Mark, you asked me to tell you what we got done this year in Wisconsin, and it's really hard to believe.
Yep.
But we had 6 editorials, including 2 on our local CBS affiliate, 6 guest columns, and 49 letters to the editor. I think I missed a few from outside Madison. Also in 2012, we added 5 new chapters, if we include the Iowa County one starting next week. We got 20 people to the national conference. We had 75 signed letters of support for the Save Our Climate Act. We had 258 million letter march postcards and at least 50 other letters, and 5 face-to-face meetings with Wisconsin members of Congress. I also wanted to add that for 2013, we have a new idea. In order to get more personal letters to Congress, we started a letter brigade. And people join that by committing to write 1 letter a month to their elected official and report to us on it. We'll send the participants a letter writing suggestion based on current news twice a month. It's something that people can do even if they're not active in the chapter, and we'll keep it flexible so they don't even have to be from Madison. In fact, the very first person to sign up actually lives in California after her sister forwarded the email. She's right over here at our first meeting. Can I mention just one more thing, Mark?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, you know, I told you on Wednesday, the Racine-Kenosha chapter, which is Representative Paul Ryan's district, they peeled off into a separate chapter from Milwaukee. And Ross Astoria and Tom Rutkowski, they outdid themselves and pulled together the sweetest group of 20 people. That's twice as many as they were expecting, and they were all crammed in around the dining room table. I fell in love with them, especially after all the high school students hugged me. But what I really want to share is the email that Ross wrote to his new group afterwards. Here's his vision for his new group. This is Ross. I want to share what I was thinking about during the drive home last night. It's about what we're going to accomplish in the first district. So we set about on our good work to pass climate legislation. We are patient and persistent. We rely upon each other for encouragement and support. We've got each other's backs and so take risks and make connections with all sorts of people. We meet with Representative Ryan's staff and convince one of them of the danger of global warming. This staffer talks with others. Global warming becomes a subject of discussion around the office. Letters on global warming fill Representative Ryan's inbox. Local news outlets make it a priority. Representative Ryan hears talk of global warming every day and investigates. He recognizes the severity of the problem. On national television, he says, global warming is a threat to the prosperity of Americans, human beings, and all living things on Earth. I support common sense legislation that will quickly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and return carbon dioxide to safe levels. I got more than a little choked up by this vision of Ross's. I'm so excited about what we're going to do in 2013 with people like Ross and Tom and their new team and everybody in the room with me and all of you out there. Thanks.
Great. Madeline, thank you so much.
Oh.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah?
Oh, hi. This is Jessica from Boston.
Yeah, Jessica in Boston. Can you tell us what happened in Boston last year?
Hi, I'd be delighted. Well, first of all, of course, Superstorm Sandy passed our way, and that helped to bring a lot of media attention, obviously, to the climate change issue. Boston CCL published over 70 letters to the editor
in 2012, due in part to the efforts of D.R. Tucker and Judy Weiss. We also generated 59 letters for the Million Letter March from four parties and one event. In April, Judy Weiss and Gary Rosinski were on Betsy Rosenberg's web show, her web radio show, The Green Front. In May, Gary was interviewed on Occupy Boston Radio, and he was also on a panel assembled by the Massachusetts Climate Action Network to discuss the topic, Is There a Climate Tax in Your Future? CCL was invited to speak at several events during the year at different environmental organizations around Boston. And five members of our chapter attended the CCL National Conference in July in Washington, D.C., where they met with all but three of the Massachusetts federal congressional delegation. By the time of the conference, three of our congressmen, Capuano, Alver, and McGovern, were already co-sponsors of the Save Our Climate Act. CCL is continuing to expand. We've been joined by a Rhode Island chapter, and we're in discussions with concerned citizens in Maine and Vermont to start chapters in those states as well. Ed Markey recently had an event at Faneuil Hall, which is right in downtown Boston, a big Boston landmark. And there he was actually asked a question during the Q&A, what do you think about carbon fee and dividends? And not by a CCL member. So these are the main activities that we have been up to in 2012.
Not a bad year, Boston. Thank you, Jessica. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go over the actions in just a moment, and then Marshall's going to train us in the laser talk. The last thing I want to mention in terms of accomplishments from last year is in terms of donations, just the monthly donations, the one-time donations that you and your friends and family make, which is a really, really important area for us to be able to grow the organization and add staff. In 2011, we raised $24,133. Last year, we raised $84,448. So I know that everybody was working hard because we have three key positions that we need to fill yesterday and the day before and 2 years ago, and this amount allows us to get started and add a position. So I just am so grateful for the work that you did, not only in the donations that you make, but reaching out to your friends and family. It just makes a huge difference, and it's a difference changer for the organization. So thank you so much for that. One thing that probably all of us should keep in our vocabulary is the people on this call, usually the people that go to the meetings with members of Congress or the people who write letters. There are a lot of other people who want to contribute to CCL, but how they want to do it is financially. We should make sure that when we do public events and we lead the Group Start workshops, we should let people know that they can make financial contributions. So thank you so much for that. Okay, so here's what we're doing in the U.S. As we've talked about a little bit, is set your individual and group goals. The second action is to ask people that you know to write letters to members of Congress requesting that they support legislation for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. And then the third thing is, a lot of you have met with editorial boards already, but we're asking you to go meet with your editorial board again and ask them to make climate change one of their key priorities for the year. I mean, I think it's obviously a relief to us on the call that President Obama said that it's one of his priorities for his second term, and certainly having the editorial boards all make it a priority is huge also. Okay, Marshall, are you – so I'm sorry. First of all, Kathy in Canada, are you there? Kathy? Given our difficulties in unmuting people, the Canadian actions are almost exactly the same as the U.S., so I apologize for the unmuting problems we've had today. Marshall, are you there? Marshall Saunders. Susan, can you unmute Marshall?
Hi, Mark, can you hear me?
I can hear you. My concern is if we're going to be able to hear Ellie Whitney, so go ahead, Marshall.
Okay, well, I'll do it. Well, hello, everybody, and good morning. So we're going to practice the second action, which is to ask people, friends of yours, to write letters to the members of Congress requesting that they support legislation for the revenue neutral carbon tax. And I'm going to do my conversation hopefully with Ellie in New Jersey. So Ellie Whitney, are you there? Ellie? Hi, Ellie, are you there? So, Mark, let you and I do it, huh?
Okay, great.
Okay.
I'll be Ellie.
Ellie?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, Ellie.
And, hi, Marshall.
Yeah. Will you be my friend Patty in Virginia?
Sure, Marshall. This is Patty in Virginia.
Okay. Ring, ring.
Hello.
Hi, Patty. This is Marshall. How are you today?
Oh, fine. How are you, Marshall?
Great. Do you have a minute for me?
Of course.
Well, thank you. I know we've spoken several times about global warming and climate change, and are you still concerned about that?
Marshall, I'm more concerned than ever. Thank you for doing what you do, and let's do more.
Okay, well, great. Well, would you like to do something about it? And I assume you would. So one of the things that we are doing, and we think it is the best way to get through to Congress, is to write a whole bunch of letters, have a whole lot of people write a bunch of letters to their members of Congress, and a short letter, you know, about a page, and we're asking our friends to write to Congress with us, and I was wondering if you would like to write a letter and join in.
Sure, I'd be happy to write a letter.
Oh, great. And
what do you want me to say?
Well, I first of all, Patty, I want you to write your own letter. But here are a few points that you could include. First of all is how you feel about it and your concern and maybe what your religion thinks about it and maybe that to you it is a moral issue. And
okay.
And you could remind them if you like of the extreme weather disasters that have occurred over the last year.
I can surely do that.
Okay, well, great. And you could say that we need public policy to speed the transition from dirty energy to clean energy to maintain America's moral leadership in the world on this issue. So that
okay.
one. And then you could tell them that if you feel this way, that the best way to address this is a carbon tax at the source of when carbon comes into the economy, and to rebate 100% of the revenue to citizens. And it's simple, and most conservative economists prefer this method. So what?
Okay,
do you
I can do that?
That.
I know about that.
Okay, great. Well, any questions about the letter itself, Ellie? I'm going to talk about the address in a minute, but any questions about the letter itself?
I do have a question. Would you rather that I type it or should I handwrite it?
Well, I think a handwritten letter is the very, very best. And I just like to say how many emails are you going to get this year or this month, let's say?
Oh, hundreds, Marshall.
How many handwritten letters are you going to get this month?
Maybe two.
Yeah, maybe two. So we think because of basically that handwritten letter is more powerful. So in order to get the address, simply go to Google CapWiz. That's CapWiz. Just Google CapWiz, and then put in your zip code, and your members of the House and Senate will come right up. So
great. Okay, I can do that.
Okay. So what do you think altogether?
Marshall, I'll do it. I'll do it, and I'll try to get other people to do it, too.
Okay, great. Thank you very, very much. Now, Ellie, you've had some success with a letter-writing party. Would you tell everybody about that?
Oh, I had a ball, Marshall. A couple weeks ago, I gave a party, all-day party, put out refreshments, and invited people to stop in any time during the day. Let's talk about issues. Write your letter. And then leave. And I had people dropping in all day, and we had wonderful conversations. I walked away with 35 letters. This was to President Obama to ask him to take the lead on fighting climate change. But we agreed we'd do it again because everyone enjoyed it so much.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and congratulations on that. Okay, Mark, back to you.
Great. Marshall, Ellie, thank you so much. So brilliantly done. So inspiring. Great. All right, everybody. Here we are off to 2013. I think that's a pretty good start today, given what everybody's done. And we want to especially thank Rob Willer. What a fantastic guest. What a great job he's doing. We'll make sure and get his paper out to everybody. So thank you all so much. Talk to you all soon. Have a great day. Goodbye, everybody.